From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This morning, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi explained why Democrats will vote today on a resolution that's deepened a division in her ranks. It broadly condemns hate, including anti-Semitism, responding to but not naming Minnesota freshman Ilhan Omar, one of the first Muslims in Congress, after Omar's latest comments about Israel. 5 days ago, she asked at a bookstore why it was okay for her to criticize the NRA, but not okay for her to question people pushing for allegiance to a foreign country, meaning Israel. Here's Speaker Pelosi.
I don't think that that the Congresswoman is perhaps appreciate the full weight of how it's heard by other people, although I don't believe it was intended in any anti-Semitic way. But the fact is, if that's how it was interpreted, we have to remove all doubt.
Let's bring in NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis. Hi, Sue.
Hey, Robin.
And just a little more background. This all started on Twitter a month ago when someone tweeted out that a Republican leader might take action against Omar for criticizing Israel. She tweeted out, "It's all about the Benjamins, baby." Someone asked, "Who's paying American politicians to support Israel?" She responded, "APAC, this is the American Israel Public Affairs Committee." She did apologize for that tweet and removed it. But here we are with more comments 5 days ago and now the resolution. What else did Pelosi say about the text of the resolution?
You know, the Democrats want to expand it to sort of make a more broad commentary about how they oppose hate in all forms. That is, of course, been a bit problematic because I think that there are a not insignificant number of Democrats inside Congress and outside groups who say, you know, you should just be willing to condemn anti-Semitism as singularly bad. And are they muddying the debate? Mm-hmm. I think what's been so interesting about this resolution is it has in so many ways exposed sort of the both generational and ideological divides inside the Democratic Party right now, not about anti-Semitism, right? I think that they recognize that that's bad. But Omar's defense and our allies' defenders are saying what she is trying to do is open up a path to criticize U.S. and Israeli foreign policy. She has not been particularly successful in that because the debate is not about U.S. and Israeli foreign policy. It's about the language we use to talk about those debates. But she has divided the caucus in that not an insignificant number have come to her defense to say that we should defend our right to be a critic. And another, you know, frankly, older generation of Democrats who are saying this is just an offensive way to talk about these issues, that you are muddying this debate and you are using the language of anti-Semitism, and you're never going to provoke a higher debate if you don't figure out how to talk about this issue. Well, and the fact that it has been a pattern is a problem.
Well, I was wondering if there are Democrats who might say, you know, maybe we do want to question the might of the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, but maybe we don't want to do it in a comment tossed off that sounds like we're comparing them to the NRA.
Absolutely. And I think that the way she has phrased APAC suggests that lawmakers only support Israel because of the influence of the lobby. And that questions lawmakers' motives. And quite frankly, most lawmakers support the state of Israel regardless of APAC. It is a position that they hold deeply. It's similar to the NRA, where you talk to gun rights owners who say, yeah, they support the NRA, but they support the NRA because they fundamentally support the underlying issue. And I think trying to equate those two has questioned her fellow colleagues' motives. And that has also prompted a bit of, I would say, tense deliberations inside the Democratic caucus.
Well, it's also derailed a lot of the other things that people want to be on the front burner. Democrats have been hoping to vote on H.R. 1 this week, their first bill of the year, you know, aimed at campaign finance, voting rights, ethics, things like that. There's also other news in Congress. You have former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen testifying to Congress yesterday for a fourth day, reportedly bringing documents that he says prove that the president's attorneys edited his false statements to Congress about Trump Tower Moscow. What would you like us to, you know, be paying attention to that maybe is being derailed by some of this conversation?
Oh, well, I think it's a nature of the news cycle now that whatever the political parties want to be talking about isn't always exactly what they get to talk about. You're right in that Democrats this week are passing H.R. 1, which is their kind of signature legislative accomplishment that they want to be defined about this Congress, about election and voting reform. That is not the topic of conversation driving Washington this week. So I think that there is also, it speaks to the frustration of Democrats that they're trying to make a statement about what they want their new majority to be about. And the conversation about what this majority is actually actually about is not what they intended it to be.
And meanwhile, what are Republicans saying about all of this? They were going to introduce their own resolution. Is that why Democrats announced that they would have to do one?
Yes, absolutely. They're doing this in part because they don't want Republicans to embarrass them on the floor again, because they took control of the floor last time on the first anti-Semitic resolution that they passed. Also, Republicans are calling for her removal from the House Foreign Affairs Committee. They say that someone who speaks in the language that she does should not have a seat on that panel. I will say Democrats have not given much thought to that. They do not believe she needs to be removed from it. But the escalation of attacks on her on the right have certainly stepped up in the past week.
NPR congressional correspondent Sue Davis, thanks as always.
You're very welcome.
Well, with just 3 weeks left to go until Britain is scheduled to leave the European Union, there is still no plan. And the EU is now giving the UK 48 hours to come up with a backup plan to make sure that no matter what happens, there's not a hard border between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and the Republic of Ireland, which is part of the EU. That's right. They haven't even agreed on that part yet. The BBC's political correspondent Rob Watson is with us from London. Hi, Rob.
It sounds terrible, Jeremy, and that's because it is.
Well, EU officials say they are ready to work through the weekend if they get acceptable deals. And we know that Europeans don't like working on the weekend. So will they get any good ideas on this issue?
That's a very good question. I mean, here's what I think what most people think is that, look, if after 3 years you can't crack a problem, it seems immensely unlikely that in the last 36, 48, 72 hours you're going to do it. So I don't think that the European Union and the UK are going to be able to pull some rabbit out of the hat when it comes to this. I actually think the bigger question, Jeremy, is, are those on the right of Britain's governing Conservative Party are super enthusiastic about Brexit? Are they looking for a ladder to climb down? In other words, even if there aren't any great changes to the deal that was rejected by Parliament in January, might they get behind it anyway? And if you then ask Jeremy, what do you think that's going to happen? I'm afraid the answer is, I just don't know.
Well, and Philip Hammond, who is one of the key cabinet members, he's the Chancellor in Theresa May's government, has a warning about the stakes of what if they don't do it. Here he is speaking on BBC's Radio 4 today.
That we're in. Because if the Prime Minister's deal does not get approved on Tuesday, then it is likely that the House of Commons will vote to extend the Article 50 procedure to not leave the European Union without a deal. And where we go thereafter is highly uncertain.
Rob, is it looking more likely that there will be a delay and that March 29th deadline will be moot?
It's hard to say, but I think that the betting organisations in this country and yours need to take note of them, because they don't like to give their money away, do they? They think they regard odds on. The most likely outcome is that there would have to be some form of delay to the Brexit process. But it was really interesting that you just played that little bit of Philip Hammond there. I suspect that we have been over this, you and I, Jeremy, as often as the UK has had negotiations with the EU. And that is summed up by Mr. Hammond, the tactic of the government, which is basically to try and terrify Britain's MPs into saying, look, you might not like the deal that Theresa May has done with the European Union, but think of all the possible outcomes: delay, possibly no Brexit at all, perhaps Britain crashing out without any kind of a deal, another referendum, a general election. So the bit that you played really summed up the tactics of the government nicely, and it's been the same tactics all along, but of course with the clock ticking down even further, which is, come on, get behind this deal, because everything else might be worse.
Okay, well, let's talk about one of the other options that you mentioned there, and it involves the opposition Labour Party. Just last week, the leader, Jeremy Corbyn, said his party would support a second referendum, another vote for the people on Brexit. How likely is that to happen?
For a start, Jeremy, without getting too much into the weeds of British politics, I think Jeremy Corbyn is about as keen on a second referendum as Donald Trump is on handing over control of the White House to the Democrats next week. I mean, he was doing it more to sort of head off a rebellion amongst the sort of pro-EU elements of his own party. But I guess that the broad answer to your question is, leaving aside Mr. Corbyn and his party management issues, is that as long as there's uncertainty, as long as the political stalemate in Britain continues over what on earth to do about the result of the referendum nearly 3 years ago, well, then holding another one, putting it back to the people, has to remain a possibility. I mean, the majority of politicians are reluctant to do that because Britain is so incredibly divided at the moment, in a way not seen since the end of the Second World War. I mean, it's people, the voters at large, that many politicians are fearful of having to do all of this again, but they just may have no choice.
Rob, while all of this has been going on, there are these reports coming in of improvised explosive devices showing up around the UK. There was another one today. Is there any connection, do we know, between that and Brexit?
We don't know. I mean, this is very early days in the investigation. I think police have obviously looked at the devices, seem to have been sent from the Irish Republic, and that makes them think of Irish Republicans, who those are people who would like to see a united Ireland. And there is, of course, I suppose, the argument that all the tensions, the sectarian tensions that Brexit has whipped up, could inflame that cause.
That's the BBC's political correspondent, Rob Watson, in London. Rob, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Yesterday, we brought you to the Second City in Chicago. It's been a breeding ground for so many successful comedians since it opened 60 years ago. But if you're getting into comedy today in Chicago, you're just as likely to get your start at I.O., formerly Improv Olympic. Since 1981, it has built a reputation among aspiring comedians for its commitment to long-form improv. Sharna Halperin, who co-founded I.O. along with Del Close, says I.O. is different from its cousin just a mile down the road.
Well, you know, Second City is putting up a comedy review, and the review lasts for about a year. Though we do have sketch comedy, our main focus is improvisation, where we have different shows that are improvised every single night. So you can literally come here every night of the week and see a different show.
Has it changed a lot since you started?
Oh, my God. The reason I started was because if you weren't one of the six people on stage at Second City, you weren't performing. And I wasn't one of the six people on stage. So I thought, well, there's so many of us. Dan Castellaneta, who's the voice of Homer Simpson, There were so many of us who didn't have a place to play. So I created this little game theater. And again, it was just games, you know, like Whose Line Is It Anyway? At that time, it really wasn't something great, improvisation, and it was a tool for Second City to create sketch, you know. And then after about a year, I thought there has to be something for improvisation that's more than just these little games. And that's when I went and found Del Close, and he said, well, you know, I'm working on something I've been trying to do since the 60s, but Bernie Solins of Second City won't let me experiment because he's already making millions and he's happy with the way things are going. And he said, so if you want to shut down your little game theater, we can create this thing I've been working on called The Herald. And I said, yes, please. And the work just became just amazing.
The Herald is I.O.'s signature format for a long-form improv show, where actors improvise not just funny scenes and moments, but characters and storylines that come to a conclusion over about 45 minutes.
Two potatoes.
You hold them against your temples.
Is that right?
We do?
No, I do.
Halperin says there are three key things that good improvisers need to be able to do.
I think it's an ability to be saint-like for about 45 minutes a time when you're on stage, because you have to be giving to the other person. You have to take care of the other people. You have to know that the only way to look good is to make that other person look good. You have to have an ability to listen, to want to collaborate. And I think also a high reference level is very important.
What do you mean by that, a high reference level?
Someone who's well-read, who knows what's going on in the world. This is a place for you to say something. This is your soapbox. And, you know, the audience wants us to help them think about some of these issues. How do we feel? What scares us? Should we be worried? And that's our job, is to explore the issues and make statements on stage. And so you have to have something to say. Or what good is it?
The Herald isn't the only show at I.O. There's a satirical news show, improvised musicals, improvised Shakespeare, and a new edition, improvised Jane Austen.
What someone who truly loved themselves cantered about complaining all hours of the day as opposed to taking adventure by the nape of the neck and choking it out.
Sarah Mobley and Kate Parker are two of the show's cast members. Years before they brought improvised Jane Austen to I.O., they were students here.
My bachelor's is in musical theater, and I was like, I came and saw some improv, learned about what it was, and thought the whole entire goal of life is to create together and to see that sort of art form where you're not the only one, but you're creating together, that collaborative practice in where the choice is to support each other instead of negating each other. It was the most beautiful part of the art form. And I was like, I want to do that. Plus, it's super funny.
Yeah. I grew up just outside the city, so I've been coming to see shows at, like, Second City since I could drive a car. And so once I moved to the city, I auditioned for the Second City Conservatory. And then at I.O., you can just pay and show up. One of my other favorite things about the city is that you can make your own space. So you can just find a place to perform and choose the people you want to perform with and then make amazing, hilarious, and beautiful art.
And what about making a living? Do you make a living doing this, or do you have to work on the side?
That's joking.
No. We do not make money doing this show. We could, if enough people hear about it, we could. I have, like, I'm jack of all trades, master of none, freelance, photography, graphic design, babysitting, retail, office management. What do you need done? For a reasonable wage, I can probably do it. And she's a trained teacher.
I'm a special education teacher. And I think improv training was everything. And having done the improv training first and come to teaching second, especially to be a special educator, to walk into a room and have to make accommodations on the fly and deal with all of the variables thrown at you that are children in their natural state, makes it much easier to say yes to them and then to build their confidence up rather than say, no, sit down, do that. You know, guys.
Improv is a skill for every situation, for schools, for business, for customer service, for life, for friendships. It's an amazing tool that you can use pretty much anywhere.
And is there an end goal? Is there something that you, like, a lot of people come through and they want to go be on Saturday Night Live or something like that?
And that's true too. And we have people on our team that are that talented and that could easily happen to them. Sarah and I have been in this game for a long time, and I think that we do it because we love the art form, we love each other, we love our troupe of all women, and I think that keeps us coming back. But being here now with you, being at I.O. and having a home here, and we're so supported, that's very close to the dream coming true. And of course we want to share our art with people, and to make a living at it that way, that would be amazing.
It's something that if you pull back and stop doing it, you feel a hole.
Oh, for sure.
Because it is an art form where no matter at the top of your game, you are still learning 100%. Learning is always continually happening because you're receiving all of this information from other people and saying yes and building onto it. Everybody that you play with, you get a different background and you're in the moment of accepting. So whatever is coming at you, you get to say yes, and it teaches you to say yes to life and step forward rather than dealing with your fears and stopping. So not only is it a way of expressing your art, but also of expressing your philosophy of life, and being in it and doing it continually makes you always reflect and say, am I saying yes to life enough while taking care of myself?
And it never gets old after all these years.
No. Absolutely not. Every show is different. We do a narrative improv where there's a story arc and everything, and we haven't done one that was the same. So every experience of doing the show is another. You're in it, and you're also delighted by it.
Now, full disclosure, my brother Ollie has been doing improv in Chicago for years at the Second City, and now he's a regular performer at I.O. He wasn't there when we stopped by to talk with owner Sharna Halpern. As you know, my brother is involved with I.O.
He's terrible.
But one of the things that he has said to me is that he feels like whether he's doing it or whether he's watching other people doing it, he's always learning something about it, and that in itself is a lot of fun, just learning from other people who are really good at it.
Absolutely, and I think that's why they all support each other and they all watch each other. It's always a learning experience. So is teaching. And by the way, I'm only kidding. Ollie's wonderful. He's not terrible, and he's going to kill me. He's one of our top players here. And he's wonderful. He's a very nice person. And I think that's really important. That's what I'm talking about, is a saint-like person who will watch the stage. You know, my favorite thing when I watch my shows is watching the players off the stage who are in the show that night, watching what's happening on stage. They are watching the two people or three people on stage, and they're laughing and they're clapping and they're enjoying it. They're enjoying the hell out of watching their fellow player succeed. And they're right there if something is needed. They're right there to give them something. So it really is this team-like thing. It is kind of like a sport, you know. You have to be there for your fellow player. You got to be there to catch that ball and to grab the ball and help them run and tackle and whatever. You have to be able to do that for each other.
So what's the next step for IO, do you think?
Well, the first thing is to stay in business because the property taxes have gone through the roof and it's very difficult. This is the same thing that happened to UCB in New York. I mean, the governments are putting the comedy clubs out of business. But the main thing I think right now is, you know, more of the same. We're creating plays. We're creating movies. We're all working and just so much talent.
Does it ever get boring for you? Do you ever have a bad day at the office?
Yes, but that's not because of improvisation, but just because I have to deal with all the administrative stuff, you know, any kind of legal stuff, the property tax. So that's not stuff I signed on for. I got into this business because it was fun. And then all of a sudden, when you get into the business aspect of it, it's not fun. That's my dog crying in the background. It's nobody's hurting anyone here, just in case you know. Yeah, you always have bad days. But as far as being here at night and hanging out with the funniest people in the world and watching the funniest shows in the world, you know, I'm in the best business you could possibly be in. And every day I wake up and I know how lucky I am.
That's the sound of the warm-up for improvised Jane Austen the night of our visit. There's no script, of course, so the actors can only get ready by playing off of one another.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau spoke out today about the scandal that's threatened his government. Trudeau is being accused of meddling in a case involving a private company accused of bribery. His former, what we'd call, attorney general said Trudeau pressured her to not prosecute the case because taking down the company could endanger thousands of jobs in an election year. Trudeau has denied any wrongdoing, but instead talked about an erosion of trust between his staff and the former AG.
I was not aware of that erosion of trust. As Prime Minister and leader of the federal ministry, I should have been.
Let's bring in CBC reporter Salima Shivji. Salima, Trudeau's comments came a day after his top former advisor, Jerry Butts, testified about this scandal. It is early, but how are Trudeau's words being received?
Yeah, I think there's a sense that perhaps the Prime Minister wasn't entirely successful in what he was saying today. This is really what everyone has been waiting for since this story broke just a month ago. Before today, we've only heard little dribs and drabs from the Prime Minister, little sound bites as he's in the midst of other announcements, you know, a biotech announcement or a climate change rally. And in the meantime, we've seen the scandal explode. Really, two female cabinet ministers have resigned over that suggestion that the Prime Minister's office pressured the former Attorney General, Jody Wilson-Raybould, to cut SNC-Lavalin, the engineering firm, a break to avoid a criminal trial. So he didn't offer an apology, which is quite important. He maintained that nothing inappropriate was done. He did admit there had been some mistakes, that there are lessons to be learned, but really, as you said, frame this as an erosion of trust between the former attorney general and his office. And he says, you know, if he apologized for anything, it would have been for his leadership, for not recognizing that there was this breakdown in trust. He still pointed to Jody Wilson-Raybould as not having come to him to tell him that she was worried about these things. And he framed everything in the context of jobs, the importance of jobs.
Is the company going to now be prosecuted and jobs might be lost? And what happens to the Trudeau administration? Are they going to, I mean, people have said this could even bring them down if it's interference.
Yeah, so first off, for the SNC-Lavalin case, the corruption trial, it is still ongoing. It is in the preliminary hearing stages, and that process will take time. Nothing has intervened in that yet. And, of course, the Liberal government, even though they're saying a decision could still be made, it is within the law to still have the Attorney General intervene. It would look very poorly on them if that would indeed happen. As you mentioned, this is an election year for the Liberal government. This is really important, and the scandal doesn't look like it's going away anytime soon. So Justin Trudeau does have the support of his cabinet. After those two women have resigned, the rest of the cabinet ministers say they have the prime minister has their full confidence. A Justice House Committee investigation is ongoing. Will we hear again from Wilson Raybould with more testimony? That is entirely possible. An Ethics Commission investigation is ongoing as well. And it's clear from early polling that the prime minister has taken a hit in his reputation in this. Canadians are wondering what has happened and whether this was the government that they elected. The Trudeau government really was elected on the idea of sunny ways, a different way of governing. And this scandal sort of calls all of that into question. So it not great for the Trudeau government. And this issue will certainly plague them for the next few weeks, and if not months.
Salima Sivji, senior reporter at the Parliamentary Bureau in Ottawa for the CBC. Salima, thank you.
You're welcome.
The word socialism has made its way into our politics a lot recently. Last week, Vice President Mike Pence derided Democratic health plans as socialist. And over the weekend, President Trump used the word repeatedly to condemn Democratic policies.
Democrat lawmakers are now embracing socialism. They want to replace individual rights with total government domination.
So how did the word socialism become a scare tactic in American politics? Joining us to look at the history are historians Nathan Connolly and Ed Ayers, co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Hi, guys.
Hey.
Thanks.
So if you look up socialism in the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, one of the definitions is socialism is a system or society in which there is no private property and, quote, the means of production are controlled by the state. Nathan, that does not sound like the American system that we know today.
I think many people would assume that socialism is very un-American, but there also are very different stripes of it. And in the European strain, there was a great emphasis on to each according to their need, from each according to their skill. On the American side, you have a certain commitment to maybe a revolutionary rhetoric, but reformist implementation for the most part. And the other thing that may surprise people is that just day-to-day practices that we would today call socialistic, perhaps, certainly publicly owned lands represent a kind of socialism, whether you're talking about parks or grazing land, and even something like, say, eminent domain, which is the taking of private property for a public good, is actually a very American practice, moving something from a market to a non-market use, per se.
Ed, do you agree with that, that socialism is part of the American story?
Yeah, and I would also maybe expand our understanding of a little bit to think about the Shakers, for example, who seem so American and unthreatening, believed in socialism.
And remind us who the Shakers were, by the way.
Well, the Shakers, a religious sect that believed that in simplicity, and you know, people think of Shaker furniture, kind of embodies, you know, nothing wasted, everything shared. Mm-hmm. They were called Shakers because, like Quakers, you know, their enemies made fun of the way that when they were possessed by the spirit, they would shake or quake. So, you know, today you can visit their communal home place in New England, and it looks so pretty and nice, but it's socialism, too. So I think, as Nathan is suggesting, we need to remember there's lots of different varieties of this.
And when did socialism start to become a dirty word?
Well, before it really became a dirty word, it became a very popular word. The second best-selling book of the 19th century was Edward Bellamy's Looking Backward, which actually is a utopian vision of what America might be in the future. And there were utopian you know, Bellamy clubs all across the United States. And so that's in 1888. That recently, in the middle of the Gilded Age, you know, which had the great wealth disparities that we're seeing today. Some people talk about living the second Gilded Age. Well, that was the first one when people were so shocked about what concentration of wealth meant and what corporate power meant. People immediately started imagining what an alternative might be. And one of the men who came out of that culture was Eugene V. Debs from Terre Haute, Indiana, who became the great socialist of American history. And I guess to answer your question, it was around Debs that socialism began to become a dirty word.
So, you know, Debs is a figure that is, you know, by many accounts considered the most important American socialist of all time. But there's a broad base to the socialist movement in the late 19th and early 20th century. So much so, in fact, that you have entire government organizations that are built to basically police and try to drum socialists out of American society. What we might call the first Red Scare in the 19-teens and 20s was an effort to basically treat socialists as if they were the same as anarchists, as if they were the same as just general, you know, terrorists. And you have a man, an attorney general by the name of A. Mitchell Palmer, who takes it upon himself to basically create an entire radical division of the Justice Department, populated in the early going by a young J. Edgar Hoover, to begin to crack down on those who espouse what they believe to be socialist ideas.
And they felt they had to do that because the socialists sort of peaked in 1912, right before World War I. They got, Debs got 6% of the vote, which is 900,000 people voting for somebody calling himself a socialist.
Now, you mentioned, Ed, that the word socialism took on an important meaning during the Gilded Age. What about during the Great Depression? How did people view socialism when things weren't so good?
Yeah, you know, so socialism sort of fades away. Debs is put into prison for opposing World War I. He stays there until 1921 when he has deteriorating health. And so you don't hear much about it. You know, we picture the 20s and the flappers and all the prosperity and so forth. But then, of course, all that comes crashing down in the Great Depression. And people begin to suspect that Roosevelt is really a socialist. And that even though he's doing great things like creating Social Security Administration, or maybe because he's doing great things like creating the Social Security Administration, people begin to really believe that he's taking America in a direction that's too close to that being followed by Russia.
And what about after the Great Depression? Or how did the idea of socialism evolve in the last 100 years or so?
So during the Depression, you obviously have the federal government stepping into a host of sectors to try to salvage the American economy. So they're stepping into agriculture, they're stepping into housing. And in many of those sectors where you have private capital trying to make its money, they'll use pejoratives like creeping socialism to describe anything the government is doing. So landlords, for example, hated public housing and talked about it as being creeping socialism. And that was a debate that raged through the mid-20th century around whether or not there would be, you know, robust public housing projects around different corners of urban America. At the same time, you have people like A. Philip Randolph, who is a black labor organizer, who's advancing a cause of civil rights, arguing that basically, you know, capitalism creates divisions between white and black workers. And so a socialist position would create greater racial equality. And Randolph himself, who lived very long, you know, brought this impulse of trying to balance a socialist position, in effect, into the 1960s with the March on Washington in 1963, which we don't tend to think about as a grand socialist protest. But if you look at the actual principles of the manifesto, they're very clear. And they say that integration in the fields of transportation, public accommodation, education, and housing will be of limited extent and duration so long as fundamental economic inequality along racial lines persists. And it's that connection between economic and racial inequality that many socialists of color tried to carry into the late 70s and beyond.
Okay, and that brings us to the Cold War. And of course, we have to talk about McCarthyism. Ed, that must have shaped the definition of socialism in America in a big way.
Well, it did. You know, so a lot of the criticism of the civil rights movement that Nathan was just talking about is these people who are leading it are commies, right? If you want to discredit anybody. Mm-hmm. And of course, McCarthy coming out in the early 1950s claiming to have found communists embedded throughout the government,
right,
a kind of deep state, if you will, became the great cause in which people, this creeping socialism that Nathan talked about, it didn't seem to be creeping anymore. It seemed to really be kind of taking over the federal government in the vision of McCarthyites.
And after that, you know, you wouldn't even think that it would be possible for somebody to run with the word socialism in their party name and do well. But then here we are now. And socialism is back. And you've got people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democratic Socialist, Bernie Sanders, did so well in the last election, is now kind of the front runner among the Democrats who are running at the moment, also Democratic Socialist. What happened?
So, I mean, through the 1970s and 80s, most mainstream politicians would flee from the very notion that they could be associated with socialism, right? Folks on the new left, you know, basically were demobilized. And you have someone like Ronald Reagan, who certainly was able to fan a vision of Americanism that placed socialism on the outside of it. You think about the Democratic Party through the 1990s under Bill Clinton, and even now in the early 20th century, you know, they weren't really trying to take up the mantle of socialism. What's so remarkable is that many of the same principles that guided someone like A. Philip Randolph or Martin Luther King even, who defined himself as a democratic socialist, were part of this attempt to again think about the Americanness of the institution, going all the way back to someone like Debs and saying, look, if our job as democratic socialists is to make sure that capitalism's excesses don't crush the working class or don't make it possible to prey on, you know, poor people, then we're basically being good Americans. And so there's an effort now to try to collapse, as what happened in the 19th century, the relationship between being a good American and basically being conversant in some of the key principles of socialist reform.
Ed Ayers and Nathan Connolly, co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And again, Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are Democratic Socialists. That party says it believes that both the economy and society should be run democratically to meet public needs, not to make profits for a few.
The L.A. Lakers superstar LeBron James flew past his childhood hero Michael Jordan last night.
LeBron takes it to the rim and finishes with the left, and he's fouled. The legend of LeBron continues. He moves past his idol, MJ, for fourth on the all-time scoring list.
That's right. James is now number four on the all-time scoring list. Say it with me, behind Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Karl Malone, and Kobe Bryant. Such an emotional moment. He cried behind a towel. They played videos. And the Lakers still lost to the Denver Nuggets, their fourth loss in a row, their eighth in 10 games, bogged down in what Slate called the Great Plains of Sadness. In fact, the Lakers, led by LeBron, are dangerously close to missing the playoffs. Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst, is here. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, yikes.
Yes.
What happened here?
They are going to miss the playoffs. I mean, it's not done. They're not mathematically eliminated, but the sites that both crunch the numbers of how good they are, how good their schedule is, and how good their competition is, all give them a less than 1% chance of making the playoffs. And what happened is, I think, two or threefold. One, the West is good, but that's not a surprise. We thought they would be. Two, LeBron is not bad. He's still a top 10 player. But, you know, from about 2007 and 8 to about 2013, he was best player in the NBA, best player in the world. Mm. Now, when we say he's a top 10 player, I mean, so is Karl Anthony Towns. Do we naturally expect that guy's teams to make the playoffs? And the third thing is LeBron is more than a player. What he wants goes. He gets to dictate who the team trades for, who they don't trade for. And he's not been good at this, by the way, throughout his career. He did this at Cleveland. It's tough to expect someone to be. But his will has not, when it has been pursued or executed, it has not redounded to the success of his franchise, shall we say.
Well, wasn't he injured this year as well? But
yeah.
Just to remind people, he signed on with the Lakers last summer after, of course, well, we shouldn't say of course. Some people may not be following this, but he was with the Cleveland Cavaliers twice. This was huge for the Lakers at the time, but, you know, they're a young team. They've got a new head coach. As you say, maybe he is calling too many of the shots. But last night, here's what he said post-game when a reporter asked what he expects from his teammates if the Lakers are eliminated from the playoffs.
Oh, I have no idea. You know, for me personally, I can speak for myself. I continue to be the professional and to be as great as you can be every single night, no matter the circumstances, because someone's always watching.
Yeah, it sounds like he may be resigned to things. What happens if they don't make the playoffs?
They go on. There are some people. And by the way, NBA Twitter and NBA rumors are more out of control than the Kardashians. So people have theories. But I think they try again and they acquire better players in the offseason. One of the big moves that hurt the team is maybe the best player, one of the best players in the NBA, the center, Anthony Davis from the Pelicans, made it known he wanted to be traded. And then what happened is LeBron went out and tried to facilitate a trade. Well, when you do that and you start talking about all the pieces on your team who you're willing to move to for this hypothetical, what you're saying is, I'm not too interested in playing with my current teammates. So that somewhat poisons the situation, but it is possible that Anthony Davis next year will be traded. And if he comes to a LeBron James team, that alone would make them one of the best teams in the world. I still think that LeBron James can turn it up in a playoff situation, can make a deep run, can win an NBA Finals. Got to get to the playoffs first.
Okay. Well, but just staying with the NBA, Commissioner Adam Silver spoke at the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference recently about how depressed players are when he meets them. Let's listen.
You know, I think to the outside world, they see the fame, the money, all the trappings that go with it. They're the best in the world at what they do. You know, they say, how is it possible? Like, they could even be complaining. And I hear this on television all the time. A lot of these young men are genuinely unhappy.
What's going on here?
A couple things. I think he's diagnosing the problem correctly. I think that it is a condition of the age. No one's on social media more than these players. And we all see them just like everyone else. They put forward their Instagram or social media selves, and they seem to be on top of the world. And why wouldn't they be? But like all human beings, they have failings, and they have flaws, and they have anxiety. And I mean, this is a separate conversation, but I think social media are these like perfectly designed anxiety machines that we've all let into our lives. That said, step back for a second and think about, and let's compliment how amazing it is to have the commissioner of a sport being on the forefront of empathizing with his workers. Hmm. Many of us would like to have, if not a boss, but a boss's boss's boss who is that smart and that sharp and that astute. And you compare it to other leagues where at minimum, there's a tension between management and players. And I do think in some leagues like the NFL, there's just outright animosity. Adam Silver always calls his players, and they're not his players, always calls the players his partners. He really does seem to have their best interest in mind. These sort of statements, I think, will convince them that, you know, he and them are on the same page. Huh. And I think it's really remarkable that he goes so far. And it's a thing that's really laudatory.
And maybe they'll be doing something about that depression. Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst, also the host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, thanks.
You're welcome.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young with Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.